Such a rich and diverse musical haven.
Tuesday, Wednesday and Thursday nights at 11 o'clock on BBC Radio 3. And also, when you choose, at bbc.co.uk/radio3.
Well, this is BBC Radio 3. We're on 90 to 93 FM, on digital radio and also online. It's 1 o'clock. Time for the news, read by Vaughan Savage.
Figures from the world of golf have been paying tribute to Seve Ballesteros, who has died at the age of 54. He was diagnosed with a brain tumour 2.5 years ago. The Spaniard won the Open title 3 times, the Masters twice, and led a golden age in European golf as player and captain in the Ryder Cup. World number one Lee Westwood called him an inspiration, while former Ryder Cup captain Bernard Gallagher described him as Europe's best ever player. The Liberal Democrat Business Secretary Vince Cable has branded his Conservative coalition partners as ruthless, calculating and tribal. But he said the parties will continue working together to put the economy on a stable footing. He was speaking in the wake of his party's local election losses and the rejection of a new voting system. Counting is continuing in Northern Ireland's Assembly elections, where the Democratic Unionist Party and Sinn Féin look set to retain their positions as the two biggest parties. With some results still to be declared, the DUP have 23 seats, with Sinn Féin on 15. Forces loyal to Colonel Gaddafi have reportedly been scattering landmines at the port of Misrata. The mines were said to be dropped onto the dockside from the air. The port is the only route for civilians to leave the city and for aid to be brought in. Reports from Syria say tanks have moved into the port city of Banias, which has seen some of the most persistent anti-government demonstrations in recent weeks. It comes after activists claimed 21 people were shot dead by security forces in the cities of Hama and Homs yesterday. A man's been remanded in custody charged with murdering a young woman as she walked home from work. David Simmons, who's 21, is accused of killing Gia Ashton in Summercoats in Derbyshire last month. The economics graduate failed to arrive home after leaving her job at a Thornton's factory. Her body was found in woodland 3 days later. The weather. Most places can expect a mixture of showers and sunny spells, although it will still feel quite warm. Some of the showers are likely to be heavy and thundery, particularly in southern and western areas and in Scotland. The BBC News and Weather at 1:02 past 1.
And that was Vaughan Savage. I'm Jill Anderson. Good afternoon to you. Looking ahead to 6 o'clock this evening, we'll be going live to the Metropolitan Opera in New York for a performance of Richard Strauss's Ariadne auf Naxos. The cast includes Violetta Ormán, Joyce DiDonato, Kathleen Kim and Thomas Allen, with the Metropolitan Opera Chorus and Orchestra conducted by Fabio Luisi. That's 6 o'clock this evening here on Radio 3. But it's time now to join Lucy Skeeping for the Early Music Show.
Bit of a fanfare to begin today's early music show. No, we're not getting above ourselves. That was, in fact, the overture to a brilliant piece of music theatre, first seen and heard on the London stage in the spring of 1692. Henry Purcell's The Fairy Queen, which we're exploring today, and we'll be hearing music from a variety of recordings throughout the programme. It was first performed in London's Dorset Gardens Theatre, which stood near the north bank of the Thames, not far from Somerset House. And it's based on Shakespeare's Midsummer Night's Dream, although much of the play was adapted or cut, partly to satisfy audience tastes at the time, and partly to make way for a series of five masks, one in each act, which contain some of Purcell's finest music. Nevertheless, the writer did retain most of the play's fundamental elements. We meet Bossum and his friends, the Rude Mechanicals, the lovers who spend their time chasing each other, and, of course, the famous characters from the fairy world, Titania, Oberon and Puck, whose magic and mischief is responsible for so much confusion. But Purcell's musical interludes introduce new elements too. They may at first appear to be totally unrelated to the plot, but they offer a sort of subtext, symbolic references to marriage, to human nature and to love, even to the power of words themselves, as portrayed by the character of the drunken poet in Act One, who we'll hear now. "Fill up the bowl," he sings, his stutter making him instantly recognisable to the audience as Purcell's old friend and collaborator Thomas Durfee, whose famous stutter had long made him the butt of jokes. "I am drunk, boys, as I live. I am a scurvy poet." His inebriated, staggering rhythms contrast sharply with the fairy's playful torments. Trip it in a ring and pinch him for his crimes.
Fill up the bowl, then fill up the bowl, then fill up the bowl, then. I'm drunk.
Michael Schoppe as the drunken poet tormented by the fairies in the first of Purcell's musical masks from his semi-opera The Fairy Queen. Tom Koopman directed the Amsterdam Baroque Orchestra and Choir. A whopping £3,000 had been invested in The Fairy Queen, which paid for, not least, a huge amount of promotional activity, with articles appearing in popular journals and even some of the hit songs available for sale in the music shops well in advance. But it also helped to fund the very latest in stage machinery. After all, Purcell's audiences didn't just want to hear great lines of prose. In fact, Samuel Pepys had been very unimpressed by Shakespeare's original. "The most insipid, ridiculous play I ever saw," he called it. No, Restoration theatre-goers wanted to see wondrous visions as well. Dances, fancy costumes, trapdoors that demons could pop out of, and elaborate machinery that would lower gods and goddesses onto the stage before their eyes. All this may have been standard stuff when it came to the courtly masks seen by the privileged few, but it was quite a recent development in the public theatres. And according to John Downes, the prompter at Dorset Gardens Theatre, both court and town were wonderfully satisfied with it. As for the cast, well, there was a clear division of labour between actors and singers. But you never get the sense that Purcell was in any way constrained by this semi-opera form. In fact, because he had proper singers rather than just singing actors, he was able to write much more difficult vocal parts, and a wonderful stream of catchy tunes seems to flow effortlessly throughout the score. He also gives us an astonishing range of orchestral colours and moods, from the brightest trumpet to the shimmering of the muted strings we'll hear in this next excerpt. It's the Mask of Sleep, in which Titania prepares herself for bed, aided by four allegorical characters. Night and mystery are the first to lull her into gentle oblivion. Then comes secrecy, with what's surely one of Purcell's greatest tunes, a sensual countertenor aria. One charming night make the pleasure last longer than a thousand, thousand days. And finally, sleep takes over. Slowly, quietly and with tender pauses, the pitch lowering further and further, taking Titania into the deepest of slumbers.
Thank you. Thank you.
Titania is lulled into sleep. The four soloists there were Gillian Fisher, Anne Murray, Michael Chance and Michael George, directed by Harry Christophers. Well, with Titania consigned to the land of Nod, we now enter the world of pure comedy, and much of it recognisable from Shakespeare's original. The mechanicals rehearse their Pyramus and Thisbe. Puck transforms Bottom into an ass, and Titania becomes infatuated with him. And it's her call for music to entertain him that heralds the third of Purcell's masks, on the subject of love, naturally. Here, the technical team behind the Fairy Queen seem to have gone into overdrive. At the beginning of this scene, the directions tell us two swans come swimming through a bridge made of dragons. They then transform into fairies and dance. The bridge vanishes, and the trees that were bent over raise themselves upright. All this Baroque spectacle, though, just serves to emphasise even further the rustic stupidity of the characters who star in the mask. Two country clowns in the form of Corydon, who presses in vain for a kiss, and hopefully more, and Mopsa, played by a man in drag, who resists his advances with some force. "Why now, Sir Clown, what makes you so bold? I'll trust you so far. Should I give an inch, you'll soon take an L."
Now the maids and the men are making a pay. We've left the dull fools, we've left the dull fools, and are stolen away. And Mopsa no more be coy as before, but let's merrily, 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 merrily play. And kiss, and kiss, and kiss, and kiss, and kiss the sweet time away.
Why, how now, Sir Clown, why, how now, what makes you so bold? I'd have ye to know, I'm not made of that mould. I tell you again, again and again, maids must never kiss a man. No, 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 no kissing at all. No, 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 no kissing at all. I not kiss till I kiss you for good and all.
Not kiss you at all.
Oh, no, 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 no.
Not kiss you at all.
Oh, no, 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 no.
Not at all.
No kissing at all.
Not kiss you at all.
No, no, no.
Why no?
No, no.
Why no?
No kissing.
Why no?
No, 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 no.
Why no, 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 no?
But I'll kiss you.
No kissing at all. Should you give me a scar, 'twould not lessen your scar. Then bid me cheerfully, cheerfully kiss. And take my fill, and take my fill of your bliss.
I not trust you so far, I know you too well. Should I give you an inch, you'd soon take an L. They more like you rule and laugh, they more like you rule and laugh at the fool. No kissing at all. No, 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 no. No kissing at all. Why not kiss till I kiss you for good and all?
So small a request, you must not, you cannot, you shall not deny. Nor will I admit of another, another reply. You must not, you shall not deny. You must not, you cannot, you shall not deny.
Nay, what do you mean?
You must not, you shall not deny.
Nay, what do you mean?
You must not, you shall not
deny.
Oh, five, you must not deny. You must not, you shall not deny. You must not, you cannot, you shall not. You must not, you cannot, you shall not deny.
Oh, five,
you must not deny. You must not, you shall not deny. You must not, you shall not deny. You must not, you cannot, you shall not deny.
Do you mean?
You must not, you shall not deny.
Nay, what do you mean?
You must not, you shall not deny.
Oh, five,
you must not deny. You must not, you shall not deny. You must not, you cannot, you shall not. You must not, you cannot, you shall not deny. You must not deny. You must not, you shall not. You cannot, you shall not deny.
Oh, five,
you cannot, you shall not.
Thank you.
Mark Padmore and Richard Wistrike as the country clowns Corydon and Mopsa, from a recording made by Roger Norrington and the London Classical Players. You're listening to The Early Music Show with me, Lucy Skeeping, and we're exploring the five musical interludes or masques that Purcell wrote for the semi-opera The Faerie Queene. Nowadays, of course, it's a much-loved piece, but within just a few years of its first performance, the music just vanished. In desperation, an ad was placed in the London Gazette. The score for The Faerie Queene, set by the late Mr. Henry Purcell and belonging to the patentees of the Theatre Royal Covent Garden, being lost by his death. Whoever brings the said score, or a copy thereof, to Mr. Zachary Baggs, treasurer of the said theatre, shall have 20 guineas reward. There were no takers. And in fact, it would be more than 200 years before the score finally turned up in the library of the Royal Academy of Music. But we should probably be grateful it had been hidden away so long, because here was some of Purcell's finest material, a partly autographed score, 110 pages, and all perfectly intact. There can be challenges, though, when it comes to performing The Faerie Queene today. The complete work with all the text and all the masks can take some 4.5 hours, which may have suited restoration audiences, but wouldn't be all that popular today for those needing to catch the last train home. And the huge cast, not to mention all the lavish special effects, requires substantial funds, as it did in Purcell's time. The expenses in setting it out being so great, recalled John Downes, the company got very little by it. The Act IV mask is a good example of all this opulence. Indeed, it features a sumptuous scene change that must have left the audience gasping, as described in the playbook. A garden of fountains enriched with gilding and adorned with statues. A walk of cypress trees leads to a delightful bower, while marble columns support walkways and stairs adorned with balustrades. Near the top, vast quantities of water break out of the hills and fall in mighty cascades to the ground to feed the fountains on either side. The central fountain rises about 12 feet. Into all this come the four seasons with their attendants, each one offering their good wishes. Spring leads off with an elegant, rather florid song. Summer's tune is more lively, a sort of dance, while autumn engages in an earnest dialogue with the bass line. Finally, a slow, descending chromatic line introduces winter, like an aged person bent double with cold and longing for the warmth of the sun.
Bye.
Songs of the Four Seasons from Purcell's The Fairy Queen, performed there by Barbara Bonney, Michael Chance, Lawrence Dale and Anthony Michaels Moore, in a recording directed by Nikolaus Arnoncourt. And so to the fifth and final masque, which, predictably enough, is concerned with nuptial celebration. The mortal lovers, now happily back with the correct partners, are to be married, and at this point, Oberon, Titania, Puck and all the fairies troop on stage to join them, the adapter totally disregarding Shakespeare's care in keeping the human and fairy worlds apart. Juno appears from the sky on a chariot drawn by peacocks, but an even bigger surprise is in store, for now the stage transforms into an oriental garden for the Masque of Hymen, which includes this aria, Thus the Gloomy World. It's sung by the character of the Chinese man, but Purcell nevertheless accompanies it with a reassuringly English trumpet part.
Thus, 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 thus the gloom.
John Mark Ainslie as a Chinese man, part of the final mask in Purcell's Fairy Queen. And that excerpt was from a recording by the 16 Choir and Orchestra, directed by Harry Christophers. Finally, the mythical god Hymen appears, although somewhat grumpily, since he's evidently seen all this before. I hate to wait on vows where love hardly outlives the wedding night. It's all very cynical, but his mood is brightened by a very jolly duet in which his symbolic torch is lit once more. Hymen has come round and all is well again.
Yeah.
Hyman gives his blessings to both the mortal and the fairy couplings. Michael Schopper with sopranos Els Bongers and Catherine Bott. But of course, no show of this period could possibly end without a communal dance. And in a finale reminiscent of a Stuart court masque, the whole company now celebrates with a lively chaconne, very likely Purcell's nod to the French opera style of Lully. So it seems that no matter how important spectacle was to Restoration audiences, it's Purcell's music that has the final word, and it shows him to have been a true man of the theatre. Here's Roger Norrington and the London Classical Players to end the programme with the final dance from The Fairy Queen.
The final dance from Purcell's Fairy Queen from the recording by the London Classical Players conducted by Roger Norrington. And that ends the Early Music Show, which was presented by Lucy Skeeping. You can hear lots more Purcell next week here on Radio 3 as he's our Composer of the Week, starting on Monday at 12 o'clock with Donald MacLeod. In tomorrow's Early Music Show, Catherine Bott talks to the Danish harpsichordist Lars Ulrik Mortensen about his role as artistic director of Concerto Copenhagen, which celebrates its 20th anniversary this year. And that's at the same time, just after 1 o'clock. This is BBC Radio 3. The time now is 2 o'clock, and we've another chance to hear last Monday's lunchtime concert from Wigmore Hall in London, at which Ashley Wass played pieces from Liszt's Année de Pèlerinage, his Years of Pilgrimage. We're going to hear Book 1, Switzerland. Ashley Wass plays the 9 pieces without a break.